Hello and welcome to andallthat.co.uk's new podcast series, Meet the Historians. Over the course of this first series, I will be talking to a number of historians who've written about the Soviet Union and will be finding out a bit more about their historical methods and approaches. I will also be exploring their interpretations of key topics such as Stalin's wartime leadership, the effectiveness of Khrushchev's de-Stalinization program, and the reasons for the breakup of the Soviet Union. The series will be available to download as a podcast, on iTunes, or via our website at andallthat.co.uk/meet-the-historians. Nikita Khrushchev is one of the most controversial characters in Soviet history. Held up by supporters such as Roy Medvedev as a great reformer and a man of high ideals, his political reforms moved the Soviet Union beyond the era of Stalin's terror, and his policy of peaceful coexistence signalled the beginning of the thaw in the Cold War. More critical observers, however, note that Khrushchev's lack of political and economic awareness led the Soviet Union further down the road of economic collapse and to some of the most severe flashpoints of the Cold War, from the crushing of the Hungarian uprising to the construction of the Berlin Wall and, of course, the Cuban Missile Crisis. Khrushchev's actions often appear to have been wild and unpredictable, so how can we begin to explain these apparent contradictions, and what do we really know about Khrushchev the man? To begin to answer these questions, I'm joined today by Bill Taubman, who's the Emeritus Bertrand Snell Professor of Political Science at Amherst College in Massachusetts. Professor Taubman has written a number of books on the Soviet Union, including Stalin's American Policy and the critically acclaimed Khrushchev, The Man and His Era. In this latter work, Professor Taubman tries to unpick some of the character of Khrushchev and explores the impact of this on his actions. He's also working on a biography of another Soviet politician in the Khrushchev mould, Mikhail Gorbachev. So, Professor Taubman, can I start by welcoming you to the programme and say thank you very much for joining us today. I wanted to start by asking what in particular it was that had interested you so much about Khrushchev.
Well, as you know and your students know, Khrushchev was a very important figure both in Soviet history and in world history. As the first leader after Stalin, he faced a tremendous challenge as to how to begin to change the Stalinist approach, the Stalinist system at home and the Stalinist approach to foreign affairs. And I was particularly interested in him as a personality, as a character. My book is a biography, but I hope it's more than a biography. And by that I mean not only about the man and his era, but I hope it is a biography which takes his psychology seriously. In my teaching at Amherst College, I, for many years, taught a course on personality and political leadership with a member of the psychology department. And I read a lot of personality theories, and I tried in this book not so much to engage in psychological jargon, but really to figure him out and to figure out how he became the man he was and how the man he was, that is, his character and personality, affected his policies, and of course how his policies changed his country and to some extent the world. So that was my general approach. And as I thought about how to do this, it occurred to me that Khrushchev was in some ways the perfect man to approach this way, because A, he had immense power. Mm-hmm. So that whatever he did was going to be very important in his country and the world. He had immense power because he was the leader of a superpower, and because that superpower was depends how you want to call it, still totalitarian or post-totalitarian state, in which the leader had far more power, I believe, than, say, a British prime minister or an American president. And secondly, I think Khrushchev deserved this kind of psychological approach, because when you look closely at what he did and how he behaved, he was unique. Now, you might say mm-hmm. any leader is unique, but I don't think that's true. In case of many leaders, you may have the feeling that they do more or less what somebody else in their circle or their party might have done. But in Khrushchev's case, the two most important things he ever did, both domestically and foreign, one, the secret speech denouncing Stalin in 1956, and two, the placing of missiles in Cuba, which could have led to a nuclear war. Thank God it didn't. Both of these things were, I believe, I could convince you if I had nobody else in the leadership would have done these things. We can talk more about that if you'd like. But if that's true, then that is an invitation to try to understand him as a personality, because you can't explain these things by saying, well, he shared values with other people and that's what led him to do it, or the situation dictated that he do it and that's why he did these things. No, I don't think it was shared values and it wasn't the situation. These were unique things that he did, which have to be explained in part, in large part, I think, by his character. When you have a leader who acts in contradictory fashion, in a strange way and in a self-destructive way, I think that's another reason to think there might be some psychological compulsion or drive involved. That is something that pushes him or her to do what is not manifestly in his or her interest. And once again, that's an invitation to look inside as best you can his or her head and try to figure out what led to this kind of strange behavior. So that's how I justify my approach, my psychological approach to understanding Khrushchev and his era, or in his era.
I'm just interested, you talked about the psychological approach there, and I was wondering how you gathered the evidence for that. I had seen that you'd spent some time with the Khrushchev family. Did that influence the writing of your biography, significantly?
Well, I'll give you two bits of evidence that pertain to his psychological state. The first one came from a study that President Kennedy commissioned in the spring of 1961. He had just been inaugurated, and he was hoping to meet with Khrushchev that spring, and in fact, they did eventually have a summit meeting in Vienna in June of 1961. And he did what other presidents have done. He commissioned the CIA to prepare a personality assessment or profile of Khrushchev. Now, the CIA does not, it classifies these things. It does not give them to a historian like me. But it turned out that one of these many psychiatrists they had brought in for meetings to discuss this had the nerve to publish an article about their results. And the article said that in their meetings, these psychiatrists, having looked at videos of Khrushchev and read transcripts of his negotiations with people and talked to other witnesses, came to the conclusion that he was hypomanic. Now, what hypomanic means, as I've come to understand it, since I'm not a professional myself, it means somebody who, well, I have in my book a description of what it means. It basically means manic most of the time, that is, up, excited, full of a sense that you can do anything, sort of living and working nonstop, can't sleep, can't rest, with occasional periods of depression. Now, I certainly would not have rested my hypothesis that this was true of Khrushchev if I didn't have some other kind of confirmation. And it came in an interview that I had with the widow of the American ambassador to the Soviet Union during those years, or many of those years. His name was Llewellyn Thompson. His wife's name was Jane Thompson. And she recalled how when they were flying with Mr. and Mrs. Khrushchev to the United States for his month-long stay in September 1959, she talked to Mrs. Khrushchev about Nikita Khrushchev. And at one point, Mrs. Khrushchev said, "He's always either all the way up or all the way down," which is a sort of layman's soundbite summary of hypomanic. I didn't leave it at that. I thought I saw in his life and in his politics and in his behavior signs that this was the case. And I would give you one, if I may, and that was the Cuban missiles. I mean, nobody else, I think, would have done this. He, of course, didn't ask them, many of them, for their advice, but quite a few of them said later or told me later that they thought this was a crazy idea. And you had to be in a kind of manic mood to think that you could send missiles thousands of miles across the ocean to Cuba and then truck them through the jungle and then install them. And this would never be noticed. And if it were noticed, that you could get away with it. It seemed to me a kind of manic move on his part.
How far did you find yourself referring to sort of the classic biographies, or indeed Khrushchev's own memoirs and autobiography, in writing your work?
I'm sorry, how much did I what?
How much did you find yourself referring to, classic biographies like Medvedev or, say, Crankshaw? And how much did you find yourself referring to Khrushchev's own memoirs in writing your own?
Oh, I, of course, made it my business to read what other people had written, but... The Khrushchev memoirs were along with documents I could find and other people's memoirs and a host of interviews that I did with Khrushchev's family and friends and associates and enemies, all were very important. But those memoirs were very important. One has to explain. He wrote those memoirs without documents at hand. He had a fantastic memory, but it betrayed him many times. He also wanted to convince the world of his own worth and his own, hence the memoirs are his own version of himself. But they contain many clues, many hints, and I'll give you an example. I think that Khrushchev's own version of himself might not have been a true account of what actually happened, but I think it was a true account of his state of mind and of what he wanted to happen. So, for example, or how he played the game. For example, he comes across, when he describes the years when he was climbing to the top, he refers to himself, Khrushchev does, as extremely unsure of himself, as very modest. I wasn't sure I could do this. When he asked me to do something, I told him I wasn't sure I could do that. He portrays himself as a limited man, limited in skills and limited in confidence. At first, I said to myself, what does this mean? And my first thought was, this is classic Bolshevik false modesty. All the Bolsheviks portrayed themselves as modest because it wasn't proper to be full of yourself. You were doing the work of the proletariat and the people and serving them, and so you weren't supposed to blow your own horn. But I came to the conclusion it was more than that, that it was an image of himself that he had cultivated in order to avoid Stalin's suspicions and in order to avoid resentment and envy from Stalin's other associates who were Khrushchev's rivals. After all, if Stalin suspected somebody of being too smart and too devious, the man wasn't long for this earth. He would be liquidated. This clue in the memoirs became the basis for my sense that Khrushchev played the part of a kind of jester in Stalin's court. And on that basis, he was spared by Stalin and lived to survive Stalin. And then he was underestimated, Khrushchev was, by his rivals to succeed Stalin, and he defeated them all.
I know you focus a lot on the political struggles that get Khrushchev into power and the sort of the machinations that he goes through to manipulate his way into this high office. And yes. I was wondering if you'd agree with Pipe's assessment. He suggests that it's a rejection of any kind of history from below, that the history of the Soviet Union is very much a history of those actions of the people in power.
I think that in the long run, if you take the entire Soviet period, you can see what might be called a series of secular trends that contribute to, that underlie what happens at the top and that eventually contribute to the decline and then collapse of the Soviet Union. Urbanization, the fact that millions of people are coming, former peasants are coming into the city and becoming educated and becoming literate and beginning to wish they could speak and read more freely and perhaps travel to the West. There are multiple ways in which the economic system ran down because people had no incentive to work hard once the threat of terror and ideological inspiration was gone. There was the growing under the surface, the growth of nationalist sentiment, although it didn't really burst forth until the 1980s. There was the intelligentsia with its being thwarted in its effort to write and create freely and then becoming critical in so much as in all of these things are happening, but because of the totalitarian nature of the system, they're all under control, as it were. They're all constrained and limited. And sure. So the action, the real political action, is at the top. And under Stalin, even more, but still under Khrushchev, the top man is really in control.
I think that probably leads us on quite nicely then to think about Khrushchev's reforms and why he really wanted to reform the Soviet Union.
Well, here again, I think to a degree, any Soviet leader following Stalin would have wanted a certain amount of change. And in fact, the people around Khrushchev, Malenkov especially, Molotov to a lesser extent, and some of the others did want change, if only to end the threat of terror that could wash them away themselves. That's one of the reasons why they quickly arrested Beria, who was the secret police chief, and they thought most likely to continue to use terror against them. And they couldn't help most of them but understand that agriculture was at a dead end because of the way Stalin had exploited the countryside, and that needed to be changed. And they knew all too well that the Cold War had worked out so that the Soviet Union was isolated in the world as a result of its Stalinist policies. So all of them wanted a degree of change. But what was unique about Khrushchev, I would say, was the way he carried out the change and how far he tried to go, and in particular, the way he dared to attack Stalin himself in the famous secret speech in 1956. And I think that goes back, again, if I may, to something in Khrushchev's personal history. Because I try to show in the early chapters of the book with a couple of pieces of really dead-on evidence that although Khrushchev was Stalin's servant and in some ways even his slave, he nursed a resentment, perhaps even a hatred of Stalin for the purges Stalin carried out, which carried away so many innocent people, including some of Khrushchev's closest associates and friends. So I think there was this personal resentment on the part of Khrushchev, which led him in 1956 to make that speech. Although there were other reasons, too. He was fighting his rivals to succeed Stalin, and their hands were bloodier than his. So by denouncing Stalin, he could darken their own reputations. I think he was still a believer in a way that some of them perhaps were not in the positive potential of communism, and that if they could just get rid of a Stalinist stain, that they could rebuild the kind of good socialism that Lenin had in mind. And so that too was on Khrushchev's mind when he gave that speech.
So quite a complex range of motivations there for Khrushchev himself.
I would even add personal repentance, which is a strange thing to say about a Soviet leader. But I think Khrushchev had plenty of blood on his own hands, and I think it's in my next to last chapter. I talk about an occasion when he says he's now out of power, but he's called in by the Party Control Commission and berated for allowing his memoirs to be smuggled abroad and published overseas. And he starts talking about the blood. Or he talks about it. No, I guess he starts talking about how he deserves punishment. And in another conversation, I think, which I forget with whom, but in that next to last chapter, he talks about having blood. Somebody asks him, what's the thing you most regret? And he says, I have blood up to my elbows.
So obviously quite a troubled soul by the end then.
Yes.
I think I'm very interested by that idea of Khrushchev being so motivated by this guilt, maybe this need to build a positive legacy. His legacy is one that's really quite debated as well, isn't it? Because he obviously has the political reforms in the form of de-Stalinization, but also his economic reforms as well. I was wondering how far you think his reforms were effective. I know he's often been described as a bit of an impractical dreamer when it comes to his agricultural reforms, for example, the Virgin Lands campaign.
I have a fairly jaundiced negative view of the effectiveness of his reforms. It's visible in my book. I think for a few years the agricultural reforms worked very well. The Virgin Lands campaign, which opened up cultivation in northern Kazakhstan and western Siberia, produced a tremendous amount of output, of huge harvests. The paying more to peasants for what they produced, the reduction of the terrible taxation that Stalin imposed on them also had a positive effect. I think the general loosening of controls, the decentralization that Khrushchev tried to carry out when he reduced the role of ministries, state ministries based in Moscow, or even eliminated some of them that had been administering, managing factories all across the vast Soviet Union, and substituted for them what he called regional economic councils, which were responsible for all the economic activity or major economic activity in a given region, as opposed to having different huge factories in each region managed by different ministries in Moscow. These had an effect, and it showed in the rate of economic growth. But then it began to slow down, and agriculture in particular. So that's the basis for my negative view. But I should tell you and your students that Khrushchev's son, Sergei, who lives in the United States and has become a historian of his father's life and politics, political career, having previously been a rocket scientist, one must add, has published a new book called Khrushchev in Power. And in this book, on the basis of his own research, he in effect claims that Khrushchev wanted to embark on a new round of economic and political reforms. I'm just reading it myself, and at one point, I dare say he compares him to Deng Xiaoping in China, and I suspect later on he may compare him to Yuri Andropov in the Soviet Union, who tried in the very short time he had to embark upon some reforms. So this is a whole book trying to make this case that Khrushchev did not, although he retreated, he did not give up, and if he had been allowed to continue, he might have been a much more major and successful reformer than he seemed to be. I don't know. I haven't finished reading the book, so I'm not sure what I'm going to think. I'm a little skeptical, maybe even a lot skeptical, but if you or your students want to see this case elaborated, that's the place to look for a view that conflicts with mine.
Right. That sounds fascinating, actually. I was wondering how far you would agree with somebody like John Keep that the failures were Khrushchev's own fault versus the fault of the ideology itself. Do you think Khrushchev was maybe trying to work with something that was never going to work, or is this his actual reforms that were at fault?
Yes and no. I would agree and not agree. I mean, if we look 20, 30 years ahead and we come to Gorbachev, we see somebody who did it differently from Khrushchev, somebody who was better educated, somebody who was more sophisticated, somebody who had better advice from better advisors, and that didn't work out either. I think the system was very difficult, if not impossible, to modernize and to reform. As you and your students may know, there's a big debate about whether the Soviet system was reformable at all, and that was triggered largely by the Gorbachev attempt to do so. But the debate applies to the Khrushchev years early as well. I mean, you can blame him for his half steps, for his not. Why did he not try to carry out land reform so that the peasants could have real incentives to work harder and better? Well, because that probably wouldn't have been allowed, and even Gorbachev couldn't do that. And that was opposed on top, and it was also opposed in Gorbachev's time, by collective farm chairmen and the whole, what you might call, agricultural industrial complex. Why didn't Khrushchev try to introduce private property rather than carrying out one reorganization after another of economic administration? Because the ideology was so strongly impossible task, as was Gorbachev later. So Khrushchev had plenty of flaws and plenty of shortcomings, but reforming that system was a gigantic task, perhaps beyond the power of anyone.
I was wondering then, one of the big things that's pushed as a great success of Khrushchev's time in power was the mission into space, of course, Yuri Gagarin, and winning the space race. But of course, that was also a major turning point in relationships between the East and the West, and of course, stepped up the arms race in particular. I was just wondering what your assessment was on Khrushchev. You talked earlier about Cuba and the Cuban Missile Crisis. I was wondering what your assessment was of Khrushchev in terms of his other successes or failures on the international relations front, just as a final sort of rounding up of this.
Well, I think the big point to make about Khrushchev in foreign policy is that he tried to ease, if not end, the Cold War. And that was not recognized by the West for a long time, certainly not in the beginning, John Foster Dulles. It was actually Churchill who in 1953, when he was still prime minister, wanted to have a summit meeting with Stalin's successors because he sensed that they might want to ease the Cold War. But it didn't happen in 53. It didn't happen until 55. It wasn't successful. But the point I'm making is that I believe it is true that Khrushchev wanted to ease the Cold War. But the way Khrushchev went about it made it hard to understand that that was what he was trying to accomplish. Your students may know the name Adam Ulam, U-L-A-M, who was an American political scientist and historian of the Cold War. And he once said something very pithy about Khrushchev, which was that Khrushchev's approach to foreign affairs to the West was, be my friend or I'll break your neck. And I think that's true. Khrushchev, after failing to evoke the kind of positive response he wanted in the mid-50s, ginned up the Berlin crisis, the Berlin ultimatum of November 1958, which I believe was his attempt to force the Western powers to the table for the kinds of negotiations he wanted. But of course, although it eventually did that, it did it only after scaring the hell out of the West because he seemed to be playing with fire. And then, of course, nothing tops the Cuban crisis as an example of Khrushchev resorting to that formula, be my friend or I'll break your neck. I believe he wanted to conduct negotiations with Kennedy in November 1962 when Khrushchev was planning to come to America. And I believe he wanted the missiles in Cuba as a kind of backdrop to say, well, look, you only understand strength. Now I've got strength. Let's talk peace. But, of course, Kennedy and the United States responded by demanding he take the missiles out of Cuba, and he eventually had to do so. So I think that's the big picture about East-West relations under Khrushchev. He tried to ease the Cold War, and instead he produced, with help, plenty of help from the West, especially with its non-responsiveness to his peace overtures, he produced the two most dangerous crises of the Cold War. And that, by the way, is another example of the kind of contradictory behavior on his part, the kind of strange behavior, the kind of self-destructive behavior that I think sends us back to trying to understand him as a personality in order to understand this situation that I just described.
I was wondering then, actually, the link between the psychology and Khrushchev, because you did talk a lot about, in the book, how gifted Khrushchev was at dealing with peasants, for example. And I think you talked about one incident where he advises his new assistant never to drive to a peasant village, but to arrive on foot and to always bring tobacco with him. I'm fascinated he was so incapable of doing the same in terms of international relations. Do you think it was that self-destructive nature then that led him to be so unable to deal with that in international
sense? Yes, although I wouldn't want to push that too hard because it opens me and my approach up to the argument that I'm reducing big complicated things to a streak in his character, which I can't prove one is that Khrushchev was a very limited man. He had only 2 or 3 years of formal education, although he went back twice later in the 1920s and 30s and tried to resume his education in programs of adult education. But he was a very limited man, a very uncultured man. And it was one thing to, being a former peasant himself, to understand peasant psychology. It was another thing to understand Sir Anthony Eden or Dwight Eisenhower or Mao Zedong. So when he ventured out into the world, I think he was sort of functioning on instinct, although he had advisors, some of whom I got to know very well. I think Khrushchev was sort of out of his depth in the world. And even, you know, it was one thing to clamber up the bloody pole, which he did so successfully, and outfox his rivals. But when he took on the task of governing a vast transcontinental empire, reforming it, trying economic reform and other things, again, I've just mentioned a few minutes ago what a huge task this was. And again, he was not up to it, but then again, who would be?
I was wondering then, just as a final thought, we've talked a bit about Khrushchev's failures to control this vast empire, to have a handle on it. To a certain extent, his foreign policy is living on today in the form of Crimea, which, of course, he gifted to Ukraine in 1954. I was wondering how far you think what's happening in Crimea today can be linked directly back to Khrushchev. Is that another one of his failures just coming out a lot later? Or is this more connected with the breakup of the Union and post-Soviet politics?
Well, it does go back to 1954 when Khrushchev grandly made this benevolent gesture of taking the Crimea from the Russian Federation within the Soviet Union and handing it over to Ukraine. I was never entirely clear about that. I think the one thing I did find, and it's in my book, but I think it may even be in a footnote, is that earlier, at the end of World War II, he had tried to do the same thing, and unsuccessfully. And I think the reason he had this bee in his bonnet was he had a sentimental feeling about Ukraine. After all, he'd been born just a few miles from the Russian-Ukrainian border. He had moved to Donetsk, which was then called Stalino, in 1908, when he was 14, that is now called Donetsk in Ukraine. He had climbed the ladder, party ladder, in Donetsk. He had served in Kharkov and in Kiev. And in 1938, Stalin made him the communist viceroy of the whole of Ukraine. And then he returned to Ukraine after the war. Of course, he had to flee during the war and was there until 1948. I think he had a warm feeling about Ukraine as well. Although I have no proof of this, a somewhat guilty conscience about some of what he had done there at Stalin's behest. So I think it was a sentimental gesture, although I have talked to people quite recently. I talked to a fellow at Harvard University who is a Ukrainian historian who made the case that there were economic reasons for it as well. As one knows, looking at a map, the Crimea is supplied mainly through Ukraine today. That is, the main rail and road lines to Crimea lead down from Russia through Ukraine. So it probably seemed to make sense to Khrushchev. Well, if, you know, it's right there. The only way to get to it from the Russian Federation proper is by boat across from southern Russia, across the straits, from narrow straits near Kerch. So we don't quite know why he did it, but he did it. And as you said, nowadays, once Ukraine became independent in 1991, well, let me put in parenthetically, on December 1st, 1991, when there was a referendum in Ukraine about whether to become independent from the Soviet Union and in effect from Russia, or what was left of the Soviet Union, the Ukrainians voted overwhelmingly to do so, and Crimea voted 54% in favor of Ukrainian independence, even though in Ukraine the Russian ethnic Russian population is 60%. So what's happened since then is, as a result of the mess in Ukraine, the mismanagement of Ukraine by its rulers, a lot of ethnic Russians in Ukraine don't want to be part of Ukraine anymore. And as a result of Putin's geopolitical ambitions to recreate a kind of quasi-Soviet space, he has, by force, given Crimea the chance to vote to go back to Russia, and in all probability they will tomorrow. But Khrushchev played a role in this, in the way that I've described.
So a complex man with a very complex legacy then. Professor Tabrin, I think we're going to have to leave it there, but thank you very much indeed for your time.
Well, I've enjoyed it immensely, and I hope your students enjoy hearing at least some of what we've had to say.
That was Professor Bill Tabrin giving us a unique insight into Khrushchev's complex character and its importance in determining his policies as Soviet Premier. If you want to find out more about Khrushchev's time in power, I can highly recommend Professor Tabrin's book, a link to which is available on our website at andallthat.co.uk/meetthehistorians. Thank you very much for joining us.